you my snakeskin jacket. Thanks, baby. Did I ever tell you that this here jacket represents a symbol of my individuality and my belief in personal freedom?
About 50,000 times. I got us a room at the Cape Fear. And guess what? Powerman's playing at the Hurricane.
Stabbing and steer.
Hello and welcome to The Letterboxd Show, a podcast about the movies people love watching from Letterboxd, the social network for people who love watching movies. Each episode, your hosts, Gemma, that's me, and Slim, are joined by a Letterboxd friend for a chat about their four favourite films. That is, the four films you choose as your favourites on your Letterboxd profile. We have links in the episode notes as you listen along, so there is no excuse not to add these four films to your watch lists. Today, our guest is cinematic sex sleuth, Kate Hagen.
Hello. Thank you guys for having me.
Kate is the director of Community for the Blacklist, the platform for scriptwriters to showcase their work. And she was the co-host with Blacklist founder Franklin Leonard of the Blacklist podcast. Kate is also a writer. Her long-form essay for Playboy on the unacceptable decline of sex scenes in Hollywood cinema is a must-read. And Kate has just finished a new long-form special on fat girls in film and why we need more large leading ladies for Letterboxd. She joins us today to talk about her four favorites, Near Dark, Baby It's You, Wild at Heart, and Morvern Caller.
Yes.
First thing that jumps to mind, first of all, two phrases, cinematic sex sleuth. Is that like the greatest nickname for anyone in the history of podcasting?
I am trying to remember where that came from, if that was something I wrote or if that was like Playboy copy that I then stole, but it's accurate. I mean, I've been watching movies just for the sex scenes for like at least half of my life at this point. And I have watched a lot of really, really terrible garbage just because I was told that it had a good sex scene in it. So yeah, I would say it's like a Ventura County PI, but for sex scenes in movies, like, you know,
oh my God,
drinking too many Tums and like drinking a lot of bad coffee, but like I will find those sex scenes.
CSI sex sleuth. I have an immediate follow-up question off the top of your head. What is the worst film with the best sex scene?
Oh, that's a really great question. You know what has some good sex in it, and I haven't seen it in years, is Lee Daniels' Shadowboxer, which is just like a bananas movie, but there's some really interesting sex in there. I think there's a Monique and Stephen Dorff sex scene, and then there's definitely one with Helen Mirren and Cuba Gooding Jr., that there's like an incesty thread happening in that movie too that's interesting. But I remember watching it and being like, you know, this was not great, but I have never seen like these pairings of bodies on a screen before, and that's interesting.
That seems like a Letterboxd list in the making. Bad movies with great sex scenes.
I mean, so many erotic thrillers, like, you're like, this was not great, but like, what a smoking hot sex scene this was. I'm trying to think of anything recent. I mean,
I watched it recently, first time in a long time, Basic Instinct, which I like. And that, I thought the sex scene with Sharon Stone and Michael Douglas, I was like, holy moly, they're going for that. They're going for it in this movie. It's legit.
Yeah. And then the scene with Gene Triplehorn also, that's like right on the edge of being not okay in terms of consent, but like the movie somehow sort of makes it work, even though it's a little bit squeaky. I don't know. Right. Basic Instinct to me and all the Verhoeven stuff really holds up. I love that one of his kinks is like unisex showers and like all genders in the shower room. That's just like, if it's a Paul Verhoeven movie and we can do that, we're doing that.
Okay. And then what was your other catchphrase, Slim? You noticed something else.
Oh God. The other one I wrote down, the other one, let's see, terminally horny. I love that phrase. That
somebody's got to do it. There is not enough sex in movies and somebody's got to keep beating that drum. And I've decided it's going to be me.
I think Slim is just jealous. I think Slim is just jealous. I am jealous. Like that.
I feel like people who, if you're listening to the Letterboxd show right now, I need your help. You need to come up with an equally as cool phrase for myself. And if there are any notifications on my Twitter account, we'll mention them next week on the show.
I am going to throw in a patron membership for the winner of Best Nickname for Slim on the Letterboxd show.
Very exciting.
There are stakes
this is,
now.
This is good.
Shall we dig into the four favorites for Kate this week? Number one, you know, it's October. Why not go right into Near Dark, 1987, Kathryn Bigelow? This is a 3.6 average on Letterboxd, and I think shockingly low amount of fans. I feel like there should be thousands of fans that have Near Dark as their fave. 142 people. Midwestern farm boy reluctantly becomes a member of the undead when a girl he meets turns out to be part of a band of southern vampires who roam the highways in stolen cars. What was your first Near Dark experience like, Kate? Do you remember?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually was just talking to somebody else about this story because I grew up in a very permissive household when it came to media, but there was still some stuff that was like borderline. But Near Dark is notable because it's the only movie my parents ever argued about whether or not I could see it. It got put on DVD in like 2003, 2004, and it had been really unavailable for a long time. And my dad is the one who I would always watch like the more sort of like violent genre stuff with. And he was like, oh, we've got to watch this. So we rented it from Blockbuster. We started watching it. And my mom was like, this is unacceptable. And so the movie stopped. They had an argument. And they are not like fight. They do not get into like fights, arguments. That's just like not their vibe. But I remember my mom was like, this is too violent. And my dad was like, you guys literally just watched Kurt and Courtney together. Like, what are you talking about in terms of like a content warning? Like, yeah, they're vampires, but this is very fake. And Kurt and Courtney is like very real and harrowing. My dad and I won that fight. I got to watch the rest of Near Dark and it just seared on my brain. The barroom scene that is the famous scene from the movie to me is like the pinnacle of cinema. I think there's just this pervasive coolness with Near Dark that's kind of hard to find anywhere else. You know, I think there's a reason there's only ever been one sort of successful vampire Western, because it's an idea so wacky that like it should not work, but it somehow does completely work. And what a statement from Kathryn Bigelow. You know, I think The Loveless is a really cool movie, but the leap forward in terms of craft and filmmaking from The Loveless to Near Dark is just pretty unbelievable. And you've got so many wonderful character actors in the film. I mean, Lance Henriksen, the late Bill Paxton, Jeanette Goldstein, Joshua John Miller, like all of these folks who really just fill out this incredible ensemble. And it's just a movie that I come back to constantly. I do have a theory why more people don't love it on Letterboxd, and that's because it's really hard to see. I think it's getting a 4K re-release later this year or early next year. It historically has not been on streaming. The only DVD is, I think, the DVD I rented from Blockbuster. There was a very brief Blu-ray when they tried to make it like Twilight, and it has like a Twilight-inspired cover of Adrian Pasdar and Jenny Wright. It's hard to see. I would imagine it's a music rights question, you know, talking about that barroom scene. You've got that great use of Fever, the cover of Fever by the Cramps. And there's a bunch of other great music throughout the movie and the Tangerine Dream score. But yeah, criminally underseen because it is criminally underavailable, I think.
The Twilight thing kept coming up for me while I was watching. This was a first watch for me. And I don't know why. Oh, wow. I kept thinking of, yeah, it was, and wow, I loved it. Thank you so much. I was like, denim and neck biters and oh my God. And those potholes in the windows of the motel and the combustible vampires. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just loved it all. Everything about it was wild. And especially I think the twilightness of it came up because there's, unusually for you, no sex in Near Dark.
Yeah. It's an interesting one. They're very chaste, Adrian Pasdar and Jenny Wright. Like, you know, I think probably the question, because the movie's so violent, was like, you know, we've got to go one way or another. And if we throw like some big steamy sex scene in here, we might get into some ratings trouble. But it is interesting that they have this sort of very like teenage romance. But I think that's interesting in terms of Jenny Wright's character, in terms of she's just been stuck in this sort of perpetual adolescence. She's obviously on the older side of being a teenager, but, you know, hundreds of years old and just sort of stuck with these teenage levels of emotionality and teenage levels of depth. And that's probably what attracts her to Adrian Pasdar, Caleb, in the movie. Just the idea that she can have this sort of teenage romance that she maybe did not get in her actual life.
The one thing that I knew of Near Dark before I watched it, and I think it was on Shudder for maybe like 1 month this year, and then it was gone again, was the scene at the end with the fire scene. And maybe people have seen it on YouTube, but when one of the characters is running and their like head is inflamed, it's like, is this CGI? What movie? What year did this come out? It's like 1987, and it looks so like scary real.
Yeah. That scene is really upsetting, even though like it's a little bit, it's one of those that you have to look at and you're like, okay, they were trying something in terms of like what was possible with technology and it doesn't fully land. But like the visceral and the sort of like emotional experience of that scene, I think kind of supersedes some of the jankier technology, at least by 2021 standards. I actually got to see a print of Near Dark a couple of years ago at the New Beverly here, which was awesome. And, you know, it's like you've seen a movie a bunch of times before, but seeing it in a print is a new experience. And I felt like in seeing the print, and maybe this is just being in the theater, but it felt like that scene went on a beat longer than it does in any of the home video versions. And I was wondering if there was like an edit before home video, because it's like, ooh, even in a movie filled with brutality, this is like particularly brutal. But yeah, mm-hmm. That whole sequence is very upsetting to me. I mean, there's a lot of very upsetting things in Near Dark, but it's also got such a good sense of humor. Like the bar scene, like, oh, it's finger God. Looking good, is just like, come on.
I did in my review, shout out to Image Engineering, who get the best credit in the credit roll at the end, body smoking effect. And then someone followed up and was like, which was literally just tubing with cigars lit under their jackets, which I haven't had a chance to look into whether that was true or not, but I love practical effects.
I do too. I love the makeup in this. The one Severin gets run over by the truck and he's got like half a face and you're like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. You do miss it. And, you know, I'd be curious if there was any kind of coming off of, for listeners who might not know, Catherine Bigelow was married to James Cameron at this point in the 80s, and there was a lot of sort of symbiotic stuff happening between the work they were making. And I was wondering if she was able to call upon like some of the really good practical effects folks from Aliens and sort of be like, hey, do you want to do some really cool vampire makeup too? But yeah, it's just really stunning stuff. Even the like Lance Henriksen after he gets burned and he's got the really like black leathery skin is so cool. And, you know, we've all seen a bunch of vampire movies, but I appreciate how this one really gets into the practicalities of living as a member of the undead.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about how Catherine Bigelow stages action? Because wow, we could pick any scene in this movie, but can we pick the motel shootout? The sunlight coming through the holes, the flames, you know, how do you describe it? So bullets are flying, there's sunlight bursting through holes, parts of vampires are bursting into flames. Meanwhile, there's the guy that's led the cops to the motel in the car outside. Then there's the old guy who runs the motel who's recognized Lance Henriksen from like 50 years earlier, but he hasn't aged a day. There's just so much going on in that one corner of America. So many guns, and there's so many people in different parts of this one single room. It just felt so well blocked. It's so much fun.
Yeah. She's fascinating to me as a filmmaker. I just rewatched Point Break too, which I hadn't seen in probably like 5 or 6 years. And just, you know, the great foot chase scene in Point Break. And I was thinking about that in terms of just like, how come nobody can do this anymore? Like, how come nobody has like this level of intensity and energy? And I don't know that I have a definitive answer, but there is a musculature to her action scenes that you don't feel in a lot of other action scenes. And, you know, I wonder about, does that come from the POV of being a female filmmaker who's been reared on all these incredibly masculine, incredibly, you know, whether it's Westerns or crime films or action films, and sort of looking at that holistically and being like, I can do that better because I'm coming at this from a different POV than all the men who are making these things? Or is it something in her specific background that sort of has made her very able to capture action in a way that a lot of her peers cannot? But I even think about something like The Hurt Locker, which is, you know, I don't think it's a true action movie, but I think about some of the just like super, super tense sequences in that, and the way she's able to just draw tension out of nothing. Like, there's that great moment in Point Break with the sprinkler and the dog right before the foot chase, and it's like that great diffusion of tension. But yeah, I think too, you know, there's this really interesting thing that happens in terms of like it getting into the Americana of it all. I would be curious to see how that was written on the page too, because, you know, Catherine Bigelow, I think, shares a writing credit with Eric Red on this, but I believe Eric Red was the originator of the script. And, you know, does that scene read that way on the page? Is that something that Catherine Bigelow has sort of come up with on her own? Is it a combination of the two, which is probably the most likely? But yeah, it's, I think Near Dark is a fascinating movie because you do have sequences like that hotel shootout and the barroom sort of massacre that you're like, practically this isn't that hard. Like, it's not anything anybody else couldn't do, but like, why does it work so much better here than it does anywhere else? And I wish I knew. It's that Bigelow magic.
Yeah. And speaking of like movies being unavailable or hard to find, Strange Days, which she did, I feel like is also very well at that.
You know, it's very hard to find.
The streets at the end are intense. I was pretty blown away by Strange Days when I watched it for the first time.
Yeah, Strange Days. And like, Strange Days is a movie that should have been available in moments like last year, sort of anticipating things like the Black Lives Matter conversation and the sort of organizing happening in the streets. And you look back on that and you're like, oh my God, this is a studio sci-fi movie with a black female lead from the 90s where like, it's not at all about her like being tortured or having to go through something. She's just the badass in the movie who gets to sort of, you know, win the day. Strange Days, I think, is there. I have a UK Blu-ray of it. Get a region-free Blu-ray player, folks. That's a great piece of advice.
It's worth the $150 overall purchase. It's funny that I think we're getting into a theme of the movies today. You know, Morven Caller, also hard to find. Lynn Ramsey's catalog. I will scream into the heavens that someone needs to just get her entire catalog, like remastered, make a box set or whatever.
Oh, please. I think it's all music rights with these things because Morven Caller's got such an amazing soundtrack and, you know, not wanting to do those music clearances again.
It makes me sick. It makes me sick to my stomach, Kate, just thinking about it.
I agree. It's one of my pet obsessions and, you know, putting it out into the universe that if anybody wants a very deep dive on music rights and how they are hamstringing things from streaming services.
Commissioned. Yeah. That can be your next long read for us. Honestly, I think it's just we pay so much respect to filmmakers and not enough respect to musicians, you know, whose work defines so much of what we love about movies. And allow me to use that as a segue into your next favorite film because this is the movie that changed Chris Isaak's life. David Lynch's 1990, Wild at Heart.
I just learned a fun fact about the video for Wicked Game. There are two versions of the video for Wicked Game, the one we have all seen many times with Helena Christensen, but there is a movie tie-in version that involves Sailor and Lula from Wild at Heart that I was like, wow, imagine like, it being so cool that like the David Lynch version of your video is not the coolest one that exists in the world. It's like, no, that's nice. We've got this other one with Helena Christensen though.
Wow.
Yeah. Wild at Heart, another movie I saw during a very sort of like formative part of my adolescence. I was extremely cool in high school, as you can imagine. And a lot of times I was home on Friday nights by myself. And IFC did this series in the mid-2000s when it was like, you know, whatever the Friday night movie was like a big deal. And so that's how I saw things like Blue Velvet and Breaking the Waves for the first time. But the first Lynch movie I ever saw was Wild at Heart, and I was 15. And the reason I watched Wild at Heart is because I had been told that it was very raunchy. And I was like, I will watch Wild at Heart if it's supposed to have some good sex in it. And it indeed did.
And does it have good sex in it.
Yeah, that is just one of the many things worth discussing and discussing Wild at Heart. But yeah, I just did a big Lynch rewatch with my partner because they had never watched the majority of Lynch and hadn't watched Twin Peaks. And it was so nice getting to experience it through their eyes again, and like especially showing them Wild at Heart, which is, you know, I said this to them, but it's like, you know, David Lynch has made many masterpieces, but like this is the one that really like speaks to my soul. And I think it's true. You know, this movie had a huge impact on me when I saw it, because my first favorite movie was The Wizard of Oz, and sort of like the ultimate perversion of The Wizard of Oz is Wild at Heart. And I think they're really fascinating sister movies, especially if you think about Lynch and the sort of like influence The Wizard of Oz has had on more of his stuff just beyond this movie. But yeah, it was such a joy to go back to Wild at Heart. I hadn't seen it in a couple of years, and it still hits so hard. I mean, if you follow me on Twitter, you've seen me bitching a lot recently about actor chemistry and how actors don't have good chemistry anymore, and we're to believe that these people are like in a romantic relationship and they might as well be talking to a brick wall. And then you watch them like Wild at Heart and Laura Dern and Nick Cage, and you're like, that's it, folks. Like, I'm sorry, we're fucking up. Like,
yeah,
we should be aiming for this, please.
Yeah. That is the masterclass in chemistry. I don't know when the right time is to make this confession, Kate, but this Wild at Heart was my first Lynch, and it will always be my last Lynch. I don't have time for his bullshit.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God, Gemma, are we going to have to fight about David Lynch on this podcast?
Only the second movie in and she's doing it.
I have tried, but basically it all comes back to Sailor and Lula. And it's the one that has, it's the chemistry. It is, it 100% comes back to the chemistry. It's not a bunch of fucking weirdos wandering around in David Lynch land.
Have you tried Mulholland Drive? Because I would say other one. Okay, all right. All right.
I remember, and here's the thing. I saw Wild at Heart in the cinema when it came out. I was also a teenager. It was so amazing. I saw Mulholland Drive with one of my best girlfriends in the cinema when it came out. We walked out. And we went and drank, I don't know, several drinks, and still, like, however many years later, just look at each other and go, what the fuck was that thing? What was the blue box? What the fuck? Maybe there's just a part of my brain that doesn't engage in that side of David Lynch's puzzle world. And I feel like, honestly, I'm going to get cancelled as a cinephile for saying this out loud, but I don't mind, because if it gives somebody else who struggles with Lynch the reassurance that it's okay to just not watch, then I'm happy to be that person. However, Wild at Heart has a place in my heart forever and ever and ever.
Oh, you're breaking my Wild at Heart. No.
But listen, at this point, I just will hand over to you and Slim to
Gemma's bravery right now is off the charts on this podcast. This is the first time I've seen Wild at Heart. I think I saw Mulholland Drive when it first came out when I was working at the movie theater, the video store. So didn't love it, but Wild at Heart was the first time I've seen this. And man, the two, Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern, man, they are off the charts in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, so they're talking about going, there's a few scenes in this where they're talking about, you know, he's out of jail or whatever. And he's like, we're going to go dancing. He does it, that Nicolas Cage voice. We're going to go dancing. And I'm thinking like, man, what kind of club are they going?
Do that again.
we gotta go dance. You know, he's doing like his Nicolas Cage Elvis essentially in this movie. Yeah. And they're like, oh man, they're gonna go to a dance club tonight. What kind of concert are they going to? They're going to like a rock concert. And it was like the most unexpected scene for me. And he's doing like these kicks, they're dancing. She's like losing control. She's so attracted by his moves on the dance floor, his cowboy boots. I was totally blown away by Cage in this. And you know, Cage is getting kind of a resurgence now with Pig. It happens every few years. He'll do like a really amazing movie and then he'll like continue on and we'll hear from him another few years. But I still don't think he gets enough credit.
He doesn't. No, he doesn't. I think it's GQ did it, but there's a great video on YouTube that's like one of those, I'm going to talk you through my filmography videos. But it's like all this stuff that looks super off the walls to us. Like you hear him talk about it. Like he's like, oh, Vampire's Kiss. I was actually trying to do like German Expressionist, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Like that's what I was going for. And you're like, okay, I see that. Like, thank you for that context.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Cage thing is fascinating to me because it's like, yeah, he makes some direct-to-video stuff that nobody sees, and that's fine. But like pretending like he's still not one of our greatest actors is just nuts. Like he's such a presence. He makes everything he's in better. And I would love to see something like Pig in the way that like Mandy a couple of years ago sort of reminded people that Mandy. He's a real serious actor. Yeah, Mandy is like my favorite movie of the last 10 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Can I just say also, so I was at TIFF, I think, when Mandy was in the Midnight Madness section, and I was on that red carpet and nobody turns up to a red carpet like Nick Cage. Like he doesn't just bring it on screen. He brings it off screen. He had the black Stetson, the massive belt buckle. He was the black leather jacket, the cohort of, I don't know who all these people were around him, but he owned it. He owned it in a way that no one owns it enough anymore. And I really appreciate that.
A real movie star, an actual movie star. Incredible.
It's funny to go back because a couple years ago, that documentary came out about Superman Lives, you know, his work that almost landed him the Superman role. What a strange universe we'd be in right now if those movies got made. Nicolas Cage as Superman. I mean, he looked good with that long hair in that costume. And what an amazing time capsule of the home video. Tim Burton and Nicolas Cage just kind of like shooting the shit with the costume designers.
Maybe that's
Superman
the better timeline we're supposed to be on if that happened. Yes. And then we also
that
don't
was
have
the diversion that we were not expecting to happen. That movie not getting made changed everything.
I've recently discovered there's like a Laserdisc that was an Angelo Badalamenti musical performance that I guess that Cage and Dern are sort of like Sailor and Lula in it, which I got to track down. Mm. I think it's on a certain free video streaming site that sometimes these things appear on. But yeah, it's, you know, I've read that they were sort of method in making the movie too, which I'm like, I think we probably know what that means. But, you know, you feel it in the movie and you feel that real sort of like, oh, these people want each other in a way that I don't feel for many co-stars today.
Mm. You've recently written, and you just mentioned it, the kind of lack of sex in cinema. And you've written the Playboy article that came out a few years ago where you kind of lamented the fact that the studio releases aren't really keeping up with the kind of current conversation happening. And you have this long list of essential erotic thrillers on Letterboxd, which we'll have a link to in the episode notes. So has anything changed in the last 2 years since you had those thoughts? I know it's kind of been like a slow burn where, you know, we're kind of missing out here. The percentages of sexy movies coming out, they're gone. What has changed, if anything, in the last couple of years?
I should do the numbers for 2020. I don't think they would be much improved. If anything, I think they're probably on a continual downslope. But it's the same trend that I kind of mentioned in the piece. All the interesting sex is mostly happening on TV. It's not really happening in movies. Like, you know, there are a couple things I can sort of point to this year, like Private Chat or Titane, that have some really interesting, like, envelope pushing sex in them. But those movies, you know, we'll see how Titane does in the award season, but they're certainly not like mainstream Hollywood movies. It's funny to me that sex is sort of circled back around to like, oh, that's a European film. You know, I'm going to watch a European film. But, you know, I was really, floor watching the final two episodes of HBO's Scenes from a Marriage, because there are two very graphic sex scenes with Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain in those final two episodes. And you're like, oh, right, it's possible. And we're just not doing it. Like, we're just not engaging with this in movies. And, you know, the sex scenes in Scenes from a Marriage are like emotionally complex. They're physically very demanding, I imagine, for the actors, but it reveals some pretty big stuff about them as characters and the sort of context of the show. And it's like, yes, this is what we're missing. Like, sex can reveal so much more about a character than any sort of like conversation ever could. Also, like, you know, we're all just lizard brain. Like, who doesn't want to watch Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain smooch? Like, you know, yes, two thumbs up. I would like to see it.
Even just this week, that motion publicity still of Oscar and Rebecca Ferguson. Oh, my God, for June. Just drove everyone wild. And all he's doing is moving his thumb by like a millimeter on the back of her neck. Like, that's all it takes, directors. That's all it takes.
I mean, even the publicity of them promoting Scenes from a Marriage. Remember when that like video circulated on Twitter? People were losing their minds. It was like smoldering on Twitter. People couldn't contain themselves. It was like, yes, we need more of this, please.
I'm looking at the list of films that are coming in the next few months to see if I can if we've got any sex coming our way. And I mean, wow, it gets pretty hardcore in Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn. Like, that's a whole different kettle of fish. It's a movie that starts with an entire leaked sex tape. So a little bit different to what we're looking for, but still part of the conversation, right?
I'm excited for Blonde, the Andrew Dominik Marilyn Monroe movie, which apparently Netflix is letting go through with what would be an NC-17. That's a fascinating level to this that to me that nobody talks about. Like, I noticed that Private Chat was released unrated because it definitely would have been an NC-17 otherwise. But it's been 5 years since a theatrical release received an NC-17. And in the age of streaming, I don't know that we'll ever get one again, which is pretty wild to think about. But yeah, I mean, most of the interesting sex from the last year for me has been on TV. It's things like White Lotus or Brand New Cherry Flavor. And I realize that's like a tier of sort of, you know, like premium even among the sort of streaming content. But yeah, guys, like we gotta make movies sexy again, please.
Oh yeah. Oh, actually, the beta test, Jim Cummings' beta test, is entirely built around, well, partly the writer's strike, but also around some purple envelopes that invite you to a tryst in a hotel that will remain secret.
Excuse me.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, you've got another list on Letterboxd called 365 Sex Scenes. Wild at Heart is in that. So if anyone listening is, you know, needs a year of a film a day with some decent sex in it, Kate has got you covered. But there's also a list that's titled with just three eggplant emojis. Are we talking man front bum here?
I wonder what that could be. It's male frontal nudity, which is still so rare, and it's insane that it's rare. You know, nudity, I would say, is down on the whole, and I think for probably a lot of good reasons when you really think about it, in terms of intimacy coordinators and not having the sort of gratuitous boob shot that we all grew up on the 80s and 90s, but the pendulum can't go fully the other way and just pretend that nobody is ever naked. I'm a big advocate for non-sexual nudity and stuff. I don't understand why we haven't gotten more comfortable with that. Sometimes people are just naked and it has nothing to do with sexy stuff. And it would be nice if we had more of that. But yeah, that's one of those big sort of roadblocks that I feel like is still has a crazy amount of stigma attached to it, is the sort of male full frontal shot. I'm really hard pressed to think of the last sort of mainstream thing I saw with a male frontal shot. Whereas even, you know, I grew up in the golden age of like, Ewan McGregor is naked again in a movie. Like, yes, I will watch Young Adam on HBO just to see what's going on here. And you don't even have that anymore. Or like Kevin Bacon and Wild Things. It's like, I think the last one was like that minuscule glimpse we got of Ben Affleck in Gone Girl for like 0.2 seconds.
Unless, and this is a genre context penis, but Violation which came out earlier this year. And oh, I mean, God. Oh my God.
That's two episodes in a row we're talking about Violation. I'm starting to sweat again.
I still haven't seen that because I know it's going to fuck me up. And I'm like, oh, we'll pick our moment. Yeah.
I'm never eating soft serve ice cream again. Just put it that way. Anyway. I did want to say, Kate, that I feel like this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship between you and Slim, because your three eggplant emojis list goes nicely. I was going to say hand in hand, but it's more like hand in cheek. I don't know. With Slim's now infamous man ass list.
I do have a man ass list. This needs to be documented. You know, the first time that I felt like I needed to make a list that will slowly grow over time was in Showgirls, where Kyle MacLachlan's stunt double showed that supple behind on screen. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in a movie. I had to like pause the movie and like look around. Is anybody else seeing this? This is incredible. That guy should have gotten an Oscar.
Oh, butt doubles. I would love that memoir, like a true body double memoir from the 80s of like being that person. Can you even imagine? Like, oh, I was Posner's butt. Like,
well, it is holiday season fast approaching. We're in the middle of spooky Halloween month, but holiday season is on its way. So let's move on to one of the greatest Christmas films ever made in Scotland. And that is Lynn Ramsey's 2002, Morven Keller.
Please, if you are looking for an actual Christmas movie, do not watch Morven Keller. You will be very disappointed. Unless you're a sicko like me and us. Yeah.
Lynn Ramsey, 2002, another movie that's a bit hard to find, but it's streaming for free on a few services, I think Roku and IMDb. And Morven wakes up on Christmas morning to discover her troubled boyfriend has died by suicide, leaving behind the unpublished manuscript to his first novel and a sum of money intended to pay for his burial. Instead, she attempts to use both to reinvent her life. This is a Lynn Ramsey film. Maybe folks that are listening now are kind of familiar with her work and how powerful it can be, but you know, what's your relationship with this film?
Yeah, I had seen Ratcatcher and some of the shorts in film school and was like, oh, I really like this, and I need to check out more of her stuff. And I actually remembered AV Club used to do this great, they might still do it, called the New Cult Canon, where they would talk about like newer films that sort of had a cult reputation. And I remember reading the one for that and being like, why haven't I seen this movie? And in the summer of 2011, I did an internship at Facets in Chicago. And one of the benefits of that was you could rent anything from the Facets library. And so it was my first opportunity to see Morven Keller. And I remember I watched it on my laptop. And it was one of those movies that I just immediately was like, oh, if I ever make a movie, I would like it to be like this movie. I love movies about women trying to get their shit together. I love a really unlikable female character. I love sort of like tortured female friendships on film, incredible soundtracks, and this movie just checks all of those boxes. Samantha Morton is unbelievably good in this. It's a really sort of like subtle and measured performance. It's not showy in the way that she would like ever win an Oscar for, but it's just, it's unforgettable. And I mean, to like open your movie around a character whose partner has died by suicide, and then we're supposed to empathize with them when they steal their book and pass it off as their own, as well as the money that they have set aside for their final arrangements. And she's like, I'm going to go on holiday to Ibiza with my best friend. And yeah, it's like, what are you possibly going to do with this? Like, how am I possibly going to be invested in this character? And the movie's such a magic trick in terms of pulling it off and making us really invested in Morven's story. I think about the shot still like once a week when she, that whole sequence when she decides she's going to dismember the boyfriend's body. And it should be so gross and horrible, but it's like really tender and loving. Even there's that, the shot I'm talking about is when she's cutting into something and there's that like very gentle blood spray on her face. And you're like, oh, in another context, this is a horror movie. But the way it's being presented, it's this like very tender sort of happening. And I just love the way Lynn Ramsey is able to do that throughout. It's funny, when I saw You Were Never Really Here, the moment that that reminded me of that moment in You Were Never Really Here is when Joaquin is finally in the mansion at the end and there's the shot of the dinner plate with like the little blood streaks on it. And it's stuff like that that you're like, yes, it's a hard world. It's a violent world. The world has some of the worst people imaginable in it. But there are still these little grace notes and these moments of like empathy and joy within all of this badness. And that's what you look for. And that's what you sort of attach to through your life. But yeah, Morven Caller, I think, is just like a perfect movie. I understand why it sort of launched her in a bigger way than Ratcatcher did. Ratcatcher is great, but it's a more difficult watch, I would say. Whereas Morven Caller, you just have this unbelievable soundtrack and the cinematography is so gorgeous and you're in this like very sun-baked Spain and you're like, I would like to say fuck my life and go on a vacation with my best friend and just see where the chips fall.
Yeah, I recently watched There's Something About Kevin for the first time. Gotcha. And I think my review for that just kind of called Lynn Ramsey my David Cronenberg. You know, she does kind of like horror and emotion in a way that no other director can, in my opinion. And I've seen Ratcatcher, I love that. But You're Never Really Here, amazing film. I mean, I think the last 30 seconds of that movie are maybe some of the best 30 seconds in a film I've ever seen. You know, that diner scene. Getting you to empathize with characters that maybe you don't think you'll ever be in a situation with, but you're somehow right alongside them. You know, the working class isolated person, as called out by Brendan in a Letterboxd review, Lynn is a master of the isolated working class person shifting through terrible events like evaporating through a wall. You know, she goes through this stuff and you're like, oh God, I would never do this. But then you're like, well, I've never been in this situation. I don't know. you know, you never really know what you would do in this situation in her circumstance. And one of the notes too, I think that you called out in your Playboy piece was the sex scene in this movie. You know, she stumbles upon someone who is also going through an event and they have this moment where they're kind of like both grieving. And then it cycles through this kind of like fun, jovial love scene between the two of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like the tonal tightrope that you're talking about with her stuff. It's like if anybody else was doing this, it would not work. It would go too far in one direction or the other. But I don't know. I think we don't like to talk about, we can barely talk about sex in movies, and to then try to explore sex from a POV of like, oh, you know what? Sometimes it all isn't always sunshine and roses, but that doesn't mean it's not important or healing or leads to some great revelation. And that's what I think I love most about that scene is just like, clearly the guy she's hooking up with is like not in a great place either. But they have this moment of like, you know, it's sort of like touching infinite time together in the moment that their bodies are together. And it's like, oh, well, you know, we can't fix each other. We can't fix each other's problems, but we can like share this one sort of moment in this hotel room. And I love in that scene when we see her like follow the ant on the wall, the sort of just like tiny little things of just like, oh, we're all part of like this bigger conversation about life and the way we flow through it. But yeah, I mean, it's like, those are the kind of sex scenes too that I'm talking about. It's not an explicit sex scene. It's not overlong. Like, it's not any of the sort of like traditional like billowing curtains and sexy jazz saxophone on the soundtrack. But it's stuff like that that you're just like, this is just the stuff of life. It's not like particularly titillating. It's just, you know, a layer of human existence I would like to see. And yeah, I always appreciate how Lynn Ramsey explores these characters that you're just like, how in the world am I going to attach to a school shooter and the mother who like, you know, impacted that journey? How am I going to attach to this like vigilante killer who's just merciless in what he does, except for when we find what his soft spot is? And it's an incredible feat to be able to do that. And I'm glad you mentioned Cronenberg. That's a really interesting comparison that I hadn't really considered before, but I think it's a good one because it's like all of these ideas of like emotional violence, how do you externalize that? How do you show that? Obviously, Cronenberg goes in more of a supernatural direction, but they are closer, I think, than a lot of people would assume. I'm very excited that Ramsey is doing this Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon adaptation, because that's such a psychological Stephen King book. And I think she is like the perfect person for that in terms of, you know, it's so character-based, even if we're going in a little bit more of a sort of like genre direction.
Can't wait.
Every week on this show, I feel like I say thank you to our guest for one particular movie. And your final four, the final of your four favorites, is that one for this episode. John Sayles' 1983 high school to college romance, Baby, It's You. I just want to say thank you, Kate. This was my watch of the week.
I'm so glad to hear it.
I mean, it was hard to find, and I don't think I'd ever really heard of it before. And I do consider myself to be a bit of a 80s high school movie aficionado, but this one just slipped through the cracks, and I'm so grateful to you.
This has been one of my movies the last 3 or 4 years that it's just like I tell everybody about, because it also took me a very long time to find it. It was something that I'm a big also 80s teen movie fan, and I was like, oh, I've seen all of them. But it was one that my dad, in the way that he like, you know, stumped for Near Dark for me, was like, you got to find this. You're going to love this. Like, you got to find this. But it was really hard to find. The way I saw it the first time was I rented it on VHS from Eddie Brandt's Saturday Matinee in L.A., which no longer exists. And I was about 6 months out of a long-term relationship that had lasted about 7 years and was very much like the first big time relationship of my life. And getting to the end of Baby, It's You and having just the most cathartic cry I think I've had in a movie in like maybe my life. I love this movie. I'm so sad this movie is not more widely available. I do think there's an Olive Films Blu-ray, but I'm not sure if it's currently in print. But Baby, It's You is incredible, guys. Like, it kind of beats the 80s teen movie wave. It's 83, so it's before you get into the, like, real John Hughes thrust of everything. And it sort of anticipates what those movies are going to be, but it's a much better version of all of them. And I think, you know, because it's John Sayles, he's like, oh, it's a teen romance. This is a movie about like class and the structures that our lives put on us and the ways in which we function in those structures. Another movie that is made on the chemistry of its lead two actors, Rosanna Arquette and Vincent Spano. Another movie with a great soundtrack. That, if there might be a theme, I do love a great soundtrack. but, you know, I think also the magic trick of Baby, It's You is that it doesn't stop when high school stops. It goes through the next couple of years. And that is so rare in these kinds of movies to like be like, okay, but what happens to these characters next? And so I love that we get the bookend in the third act of this movie of seeing these characters as they get into their elder teen years and their lower 20s and the effect that they still have on each other. But yeah, Baby, It's You is an incredibly special film. I don't know why we don't talk about John Sayles all the time. Like, he does not miss. He's one of our greatest American filmmakers. He's like one of the few American filmmakers that like actively has engaged with things like class, social structures, failures of like institutions throughout his career, and like should be talked about like a Martin Scorsese. I don't like, guys, look at the filmography. Every single one of these movies is really great. But I'm so glad that I could share Baby, It's You with you, and hopefully you will share it with more people, and people listening will seek it out, because it is kind of, for me at least, like the crown jewel of all those 80s teen movies.
100%. I think for especially given the age that we are, for a long time we were subjected to your classic rom-com with your classic happy ending, and bookending those rom-coms are these films that acknowledge that love is more complicated and lives are more complicated, and that actually people have their time together, but that doesn't necessarily last. And it's okay to, I know there's this thing I always, you know, couples, my husband doesn't really want to hear about any of my previous relationships. But for me, every single person he was ever with brought him to me. And so I feel like it's sort of deeply important to acknowledge those we have known. And I feel like Baby It's You does that in a sense for the character of Jill and also for Sheik. So you've got, so Jill is a Jewish Jersey girl. Sheik is a Italian-American Jersey boy. They live in Trenton, New Jersey, which is a working class town, but very near Princeton, very near an Ivy League university. And he's like, he turns up, why does he even turn up at his, does he even go to that school? Did we work really that out?
Who can really
it's
say?
Insane. He shows up there. Yeah. He's like, he might as well be the principal of that school. He walks around, he's like grabbing food off people's plates, he's wearing a suit. The whole movie, I couldn't even figure out if he went to that school. It was amazing.
Man, and when he sees her for the first time and then he steps up to her in his sharp suit and he's just, he's all business. He's like, you are the one. And then there's this amazing moment, amazing conversation where she is, she's an aspiring actress. She's in the drama club. She gets the lead role in the school play. And meanwhile, she's being distracted by this romance and her drama teacher pulls her aside, right, at one point and says,
I heard a rather distressing rumor in the faculty lounge the other day about you and some young man.
About me?
I've seen many a promising young actress betray her talent for the sake of a few careless adventures.
Yes, Miss Vernon.
A theater professional is dedicated to the pursuit of excellence.
Yes, Miss Vernon.
If you strive for anything less than excellence, you're cheating the people who come to see you perform and betraying your own talent.
Yes, Miss Vernon.
Essentially along the lines of, he is right now, but this is your future and you need to focus on it. It's one of those conversations we've probably all had in our time, either at high school or at university. I know I had one of those. And you're thinking in your lizard brain teenage years, you're right. But actually, those are the conversations that you think back on and go, wow, I should have paid attention, or glad I did pay attention. Anyway, it's just, I love the complexity of it.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you brought up the point of like, movies about people that you don't end up with in the long run, because what does that even mean, right? Like, nobody knows if, you know, this is going to be the one, but this is the version of love that movies so often present us. But I give me a bittersweet love story any day of the week, because it's just so much closer to the heart. It's like, you know, I was talking about my previous long-term relationship, but honestly, like the Sheik most reminds me of the guy I was attached to in high school that just like, oh God, there is no way we could have been together on a long term, but like, oh, you had such an impact on me in such a formative time. And like, I will never forget that. And I love too that Baby It's You doesn't pretend that the Sheik is a white knight, nor is Jill this like damsel in distress. Mm-hmm. It's like, the Sheik has got a lot of things to work out. The Sheik is like not a great partner for anybody because he can't really deal with himself in the way that Jill
can. He's not that great of a lip syncer either, to be honest.
I know. I love when we see and he's just like not very good at his job. Like,
if you're listening and you're still not yet sold on seeking out Baby It's You. And by the way, it actually is on iTunes and Prime to rent. So there you go. If you're still not sold on it and you watched Normal People, then this is your Normal People, but from 1983. Like it operates in that same space, high school through to college, and the sort of acknowledgement that these people are so important to each other, but maybe can't be together long term. And there's a heartbreak and a joy in that. I don't know. Slim, what did you think of this film?
I enjoyed it. I loved Rosanna Arquette in this. And I thought about like, what movies have I seen her in? Because I was struck by the date that she went on at the restaurant where she got really drunk. Okay. I thought that was a hilarious and real moment of just like hanging out with people that you might not see again. You know, like this might not work out. The fact that they don't end up together, you know, very real. And just those real relationships, they need to be represented more in film, especially mainstream film.
One thing I often think about is how hungry the world's actresses and indeed actors must be all the goddamn time in order to conform to a standard that somebody somewhere has decided is the standard by which you can be a leading lady or man on screen. And you created a list this year on Letterboxd called The Cinematic Canon for Fat Girls, which is in fact depressingly short as a list. Mm. I think, you know, the reasoning behind it is here are some roles where being large on screen is just part of the character. It's not the butt of a joke. It's not, you know, a transformation tale. It's just who these actresses are. Do you want to talk a bit about it?
It's one of those things that it's like you're always sort of subconsciously aware of, but it's kind of like the unspeakable, I feel like, in Hollywood. Like, I love watching people's expression change, like in professional context when I refer to myself as fat. And then they'll, you know, if it's a talking point later, we'll use words like plus size or curvy or all of those sort of just like, bleh. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I do not fit the Hollywood mold. Like, I'm a short, fat Midwesterner with a bunch of tattoos who is like not the most fashionable person in the world. And so to be in these rooms with people who are obsessed with image and obsessed with, you know, how much they've murdered their body doing CrossFit or how little they've eaten in a day, to see somebody like me just being like, I'll take two cookies, thank you, is alarming to a lot of them. And I think that sort of bias and this cult of perfection that's been presented in Hollywood has a direct result on why we don't see more of these characters in movies. You know, we were talking a bit about film finance, and I think that's a huge part of it too. You know, these sort of mysterious agency powers that be say, you know, Viola Davis might be worth more than Queen Latifah. And like, we can make the argument about things like, you know, box office revenue, roles, awards, accolades, like, let's have that conversation. But then you also have to think about the layer of just like, oh, is Queen Latifah not considered as financeable as a Viola Davis because her body is bigger? Like, is that the sort of the line in the sand? And yeah, there are breakouts like Melissa McCarthy who sort of transcend traditional ideas of who's bankable and who people want to see in an audience. But, you know, Melissa McCarthy's only been a star really for about 15 years, and that's all very new. And it's very telling that a lot of the movies on that list I put together are from the last 5 to 10 years. I mean, like, I remember being a kid and going through, like, in the way back of, like, the IMDb list and be like, oh, I'm going to, like, comb through these lists for movies about fat girls. And it's like, well, would you like to watch Hairspray? And have you also considered Hairspray? and, you know, I found other stuff eventually, but it was hard, you know, and it just like feeling like, you know, I talk about a bit about this in the piece, but it's like, you know, it is so beat into your brain from an early age when you're a fat kid that like your life is not going to start until you lose weight and, you know, you become the better version of yourself. And so you grow up for an entire childhood just thinking that, you know, your story is not important until you lose weight. Your story is never going to be validated until you lose weight. And you're the idiot for even thinking that you should deserve to see that. It's like, no, you need to assimilate and comply. And then maybe you can attach to some of these movie and TV characters. But then things happen. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I so vividly remember when Tumblr discovered My Mad Fat Diary and I started watching it and I was like, oh my God, that's a character I can relate to for literally the first time in my life, like as a 23-year-old. And that definitely got the wheels turning. But yeah, it's just, you know, as we continue having all of these conversations around diversity and what representation actually means on screen, I really think in a lot of ways, the conversation around fat bodies is at least one of the last lines that people have a hard time crossing because people can't talk about it in their own lives. They can't deal with their own fat phobia. They can't deal with their own body hatred. They can't deal with all of these just sort of societal questions we have around bodies and especially fat bodies. And so if they have to engage with it when it comes to media, they're like, I'm just not going to touch it. That's too hard. But then you end up with a bunch of movies and TV that don't represent most of the world's fat population. And it feels insane. It feels like you're in this very weird vacuum of like, but what about me?
Right. The list that we'll have linked to in the episode notes is short. And I've only seen one of the movies. So I'll call myself out right away.
That's wow. The thing. They're so obscure.
Immediately after you published that list, I was like, can you write a few thousand words on that for us, Kate? And Kate diligently delivered 7,000 beautiful, urgent, gorgeous, rageful and hopeful words on why we need more fat girls on film.
Well worth the read. I read it today. Here's a segment that I spotlighted. If any other marginalized group were as poorly represented as fat women on film, we would be storming the gates of every major studio and streamer in town. But because we as an audience haven't even begun to deal with our own internalized fat phobia, explore an empathetic understanding of the fat experience, or the omniscient oppressive diet culture that surrounds almost every interaction around food, movement, and bodies in our daily lives, many viewers still see fat characters as a second-class citizen. And after reading the piece, I looked at the list, you know, I was like, oh, I'm a part of that. You know, I haven't seen any of these films. And in the piece, you called out one movie, which I instantly added to my watch list, which was She-Devil with Roseanne Barr. And you had talked about this movie as, you know, her almost kind of being painted as the villain, but really comes out as like this really strong heroine. Can you kind of give a little background on this movie that I had never heard of until the piece?
She-Devil is great. I think Susan Seidelman is one of the most underrated comedy directors of all time. She has such a specific sensibility when you watch all of her 80s output in a row and you're like, oh my God, like the industry absolutely did not pick up on what Susan Seidelman was doing. But yeah, I had seen She-Devil as a kid. We were a big Roseanne household. And I watched it and was like, oh, like, this Roseanne character is not likable and like does a bunch of questionable things, but is the heroine of the movie. I don't know what to do with that. Like, I'm still in this phase of like, I gotta change myself. It's my fault I'm fat. I gotta fix this body, you know, until I can lose weight. I don't deserve anything good. And then it was like, you know, 10 or 15 years before I saw She-Devil again, and I had a completely different experience. But, you know, you even think about the way that movie was received at the time and the way Roseanne sort of was represented in the consciousness, despite having one of the most successful TV shows. She was still seen as this just like odious woman. Like, how dare you, you know, try to be a movie star? How dare you, you know, have this really successful sitcom? How dare you stay fat? And, you know, I think She-Devil is sort of seen as like it was supposed to be a launch for her movie career and then it didn't materialize. But it's a really interesting film to go back to, especially because it's, you know, her rival in the movie is Meryl Streep, who's like deeply unlikable right. And doing this very weird sort of like comedic romantic novelist performance. But it's interesting looking back at things like that or like Roseanne the series and just being like, thank God we had that at least, you know, even if I couldn't really grapple with the implications of what it was saying, at least it was there to sort of be like, okay, it's not just a total wilderness. There are other people out there like you who want to make stuff. But yeah, She-Devil is on another level of just like comedic wackiness that's also coming from this very grounded character place.
And Susan Seidelman is an absolute queen. I've been working on quite separately a long essay about breastfeeding on screen and the ways in which it's been ridiculed and made grotesque and mocked and turned into comedy and horror. And the few positive and good examples we have of it over a history of cinema. And one of the things I find most interesting in terms of that issue and this issue is how in real life you have all of these women who work in this industry. So on the breastfeeding front, from Audrey Hepburn, who was breastfeeding on the set of Breakfast at Tiffany's and was for many, many years with UNICEF a champion of ensuring that babies were nourished in all of the possible ways they could be, but especially at the breast, right through to Alana Glazer this year posting on her Instagram photos in her compression socks, breastfeeding her three-week-old. And similarly, with fat girls in filmmaking, you've got even just this week alone, Lena Dunham on her Instagram writing an extraordinary line that is lodged in my brain. I say this for any other person whose appearance has been changed with time, illness, or circumstance. It's okay to live in your present body without treating it as transitional. I am, and I'm really enjoying it. And then you have Lizzo rocking up in that fishnet see-through dress to Cardi B's birthday party. And I'm like, well, here it is. We're all out here in real life in this industry, living who we are. How do we get that onto the screen?
Yeah, I mean, for me, a lot of it comes down to these financial models and the ways in which movies get financed not at the studio level, because I would love to think that we're going to live in a utopia where, 5 or 10 years from now, like, fat women are being cast as the lead in studio movies. But I think to get there, we need to have some independent films sort of in the gap, or at least at the sort of like smaller studio level. And in order to do that, like, we need to change how we think about this stuff. We need to think that, somebody like Danielle McDonald is every bit as financeable as her thin peers in that same age bracket. We need to not just go to the sort of like, standard pretty white lady list for a strong female lead. There's just so many terrific actors that are being overlooked. And, I'm talking about fat women, and historically, obviously fat men have fared better in film, but it's not like they have some like great utopia either. For every Seth Rogen, I'm sure there are 100 super talented fat male actors who are not getting those opportunities.
But I want to see a holiday romance where the Jack Black character is played by a lady. That's what I want for Christmas. What do you want for Christmas, Kate Hagen?
Oh, man. Listen, if anybody wants to, give me some dollars to make an erotic thriller about a fat lady, I got some ideas.
I changed my mind. I know what I want for Christmas. It's an erotic thriller written, directed, and produced by Kate Hagen. And I'm starting the GoFundMe Kickstarter right now. That is the Letterboxd show for another week. And thanks to our guest this episode, Kate Hagen. Jump on Letterboxd and have a read of Kate's excellent new essay for us about why we need more fabulous, fat, leading ladies in films. Thanks to our crew, composing dynamos Monica for the theme music, Vampiros Danceotech. Thanks to Jack, as always, for the facts, our booker, Linda Moulton, for looking after our guests, and Sophie Shin for the episode transcript. And thank you for listening.
Shout out to Nworb for listening closely to last week's Church's episode and sending through a list of films in the splatter cannibal she-devil vein. We have sent you a gift card for another year of Letterboxd Pro. Also, quick shout out to my dear friend Ian, who says that the Exorcist chapter image from that episode is the first instance of a podcast jump scare.
Sorry. I was just looking at the image and got a fright, like in real time.
Don't forget, you can follow Slim, that's me, Gemma, and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes. The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production.
And that's the show. Hey, let's go out into this crazy world of New Orleans, go to Ronnie's, and get a fried banana sandwich.
I forgot to mention that earlier.
Bobby just rolled into town a couple days ago.
Yeah, Bobby here is the most exciting item to hit Big Tuna since the 86 cyclone sheared the roof off the high school.
You from Texas, Mr. Perot?
Oh, I'm from all over.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.